This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It just keeps getting harder to keep up with the amount of information that we have to absorb and produce. Caffeinated coffee is a popular pick-me-up, but lately a growing number of students and working people have been using prescription drugs to help stimulate their focus and concentration. Drugs that weren't intended to do this and that aren't prescribed for this purpose. Drugs that are prescribed for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, narcolepsy, and Alzheimer's disease. Their off-label use as neuroenhancers raises many ethical as well as medical questions. My guest, Margaret Talbot, examines those questions in her article, Brain Gain, published in the current edition of The New Yorker. Talbot is a staff writer for the magazine. She says people who take neuroenhancing drugs are using them like steroids for the brain, hoping for a brain boost, a cognitive edge. Margaret Talbot, welcome to Fresh Air. One neurologist who you spoke to coined the term cosmetic neurology, using drugs developed for serious mental deficits to improve ordinary cognitive function. An interesting term. What are some of the drugs that fit in this category, and what are they typically prescribed for?
Yes, I love that term, and I think it's quite descriptive of the phenomenon. The main drugs, I would say, that are being used this way now are the drugs Adderall and Ritalin, which are stimulants that are used widely for to treat ADHD in children.
Which
and
is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Exactly. And the other one is a newer drug that I think perhaps fewer people may have heard of. The brand name is Provigil. The generic is Modafinil. And it's a drug that was developed to treat the sleeping disorder narcolepsy and came out with approval for that use in 1998. The stipulated uses have expanded a bit. So now it can, it's stated on the label, be used for the kind of excessive daytime sleepiness that might be associated with shift work, people who work nights, or sleep apnea. But off-label and kind of ad hoc, people have been taking it to improve their focus, promote wakefulness, and they think give them an edge, a mental edge.
Apparently, a lot of students on college campuses are using these neuroenhancers now. You spoke to somebody who's used a lot of them who didn't want his real name used. But
yes.
Tell us what he had to tell you about how he used them and how he thought they helped him.
Yes. Well, this was a student who had graduated from Harvard recently. In the piece, I call him Alex. He had been one of these really busy, kind of overcommitted people. He had a lot of extracurriculars. He ran a big student organization. He wrote a lot of research papers, about 12 a semester, and he wanted to have some fun as well. He told me, you know, he didn't want to completely miss out on his youth. So he felt that basically he had this impossible life. He was so overscheduled, and yet he didn't want to give any of it up, and he wanted to get good grades. And so he started taking Adderall. He got a doctor to prescribe it for him. He was familiar with the symptoms of ADHD because he had a brother who had been diagnosed with it. And he basically would take it pretty regularly, but in order to power through the papers he had to write, go to all the meetings he wanted to go to, and do as well as he thought he should be doing in college without giving anything up.
Now, I mean, college students for years have drunk cups and cups and cups of coffee or taken caffeine pills like No-Doze. What's the
sure.
difference between taking these, you know, new drugs like Ritalin
right.
versus taking either, you know, old school amphetamines or, you know, caffeine?
I think what's different about this is, first of all, they are prescription medications that people are taking often without a doctor's prescription or approval. Oftentimes on college campuses, people are getting friends who have prescriptions because they have a diagnosis of ADHD to sell them the drugs or give them the drugs. So they're taking them without a doctor's supervision. And that's significant because I think people, a lot of college students in particular, tend to think of these drugs as really benign because they've grown up with so many people who had the ADHD diagnosis, so many schoolmates who were taking the drugs, that they tend to think of them as not something you need to worry about, really. But they do have side effects, and particularly if you're taking them without knowledge of somebody who knows your medical history, because they're stimulants, they have the kinds of effects you might guess stimulants would have, the kind of unwanted effects as well as the kind of desired effects, difficulty going to sleep when you want to go to sleep, loss of appetite, headaches, sometimes unexpected spikes in blood pressure. I think for older people especially, they can also carry a risk of various cardiac problems. And also, they carry a risk of dependence as well, according to the FDA labeling on them.
Do we know what Ritalin or Provigil, two of the drugs that are being used now as neuroenhancers, what they do to the brain to increase the focus or give you more mental energy?
It's interesting. Provigil, which they call an atypical stimulant, they really don't understand the mechanism by which it works. It may increase dopamine levels. It may have a number of effects, sort of global effects on the brain that we don't really understand. A little bit more is known about the mechanisms of the stimulants that have been around longer, like Adderall and Ritalin. But I think that a lot of neurologists will tell you, we don't really know the long-term impacts of some of these drugs. And interestingly, some of the neurologists I talked to said, you know, there are physical side effects to be concerned about, but you could also talk about cognitive side effects. Usually you don't improve one aspect of thinking without taking some kind of potential toll on another. So there are a couple of researchers, for example, I talked to at UPenn, Anjan Chatterjee and Martha Farah, who are looking at what impact these drugs might have on creativity, creative thinking. They seem to, in laboratory tests, help on, you know, tasks that require focus, that require really bearing down on something. And in certain kinds of tests, like remembering a string of numbers forwards and backwards and that kind of thing, they do show a real benefit. But would that kind of focus actually have a dampening effect on creativity? I think all of us have had the experience of getting a great idea when we're not, in fact, hyper-focused on something, but when we're out, you know, walking the dog or in the shower. And so that kind of thinking doesn't seem to be aided by these new cognitive enhancers.
Well, we mentioned that a lot of students, college students, are using these drugs to help them focus on their work, their term papers. There's other people who you talk to who have found it useful in what they're doing. For instance, a champion poker player.
That's right. Yes. His name is Paul Phillips, and I came across him because he's actually written about the benefits he thought he got from taking Provigil before he went out on the world poker tournament circuit. And he feels that it really helped him to focus and to take in a lot of information about the other players without feeling overwhelmed or overstimulated. And he really felt that it increased his earnings.
You know, although neuroenhancers have been called like brain steroids, and compared to what steroids do for athletes, they are not banned, for instance, from poker competitions.
That's right. They're not banned. And so anybody can take them. And there, I think people are fairly open about taking them in those situations. And, you know, many people say they are akin to steroids. And, you know, that's another issue, whether an ethical issue that's raised by these, I think, which is whether they constitute a form of cheating. I think on college campuses where you do hear a lot about these drugs, there is some discussion, especially among students and especially among students who aren't taking them, about whether this is fair. You know, if you are going into an exam, because, for example, the student that I spoke to, one of the kinds of purposes he used it for was, you know, before he went in to take an exam, he would pop an Adderall. So I think some students wonder, well, is that really fair if other people aren't getting that advantage? And should you have to report that you're taking the drug?
And I should say, particularly if you're being graded on a curve.
Particularly if you're being graded on a curve. Now, it's a little hard to imagine how that would work. I can't imagine really, you know, some of our students at our finer institutions having to pee into a cup before they're given their blue books. But, you know, I think it is a legitimate question to raise.
Now, another use that you mention in your article is that you say the Air Force distributes one of these neuroenhancers, modafinil, to pilots on long missions.
That's right. The Department of Defense, actually, in general, was one of the first kind of entities in society to take an interest in modafinil when it became available and started testing it on pilots who go on long missions, and funded a lot of the early research on it. And now the Air Force makes modafinil available to them. And that raises an interesting question, I think, which is, will this be something that employers will be inclined to hand out? It may be tempting for employers in the future.
To suggest that perhaps your performance will be enhanced with these drugs.
Exactly. And that you will be able to be much more productive and working long hours. I mean, after all, that's kind of a direction we're going in society anyway.
But in a way, your employer doesn't even need to encourage you. If you're competing with other people in the workplace for a promotion or just to keep your job, you might feel the need to do that to keep or to get a competitive edge.
Well, that's right. I think that's actually a real issue, because there are subtle forms of coercion that I think we all feel. Actually, when the scientific journal Nature did an informal poll of its readers last year asking whether they took drugs like this at grant times or under deadline pressure and so on, most of these readers were presumably scientists or academics. They got 1,400 responses, and 1 out of 5 of the people said that they did take the drugs like Provigil and Adderall and Ritalin for sort of cosmetic neurology purposes, if you will. And interestingly, a third of the people who were polled said that if they knew that parents at their children's school were giving their children these drugs, not for a medical diagnosis, but just to give them an extra edge, that these people would feel also pressured to give their own kids, even though they didn't really believe in it. And a third of the people who responded to this poll said that they would feel that kind of pressure. And then there is just the more, the feeling that I get as I was reporting this story, for example, I would mention, you know, to colleagues that I was doing it, and kind of a surprising, you know, number of people said, oh, yeah, I've taken Provigil. I take it for deadlines. And then I don't actually use these drugs. But part of me was thinking, gosh, is this why this person is so much more productive? Is this why, you know, I'm so behind on my deadline? You know, and you do feel that maybe you're not quite keeping up. And I think there's a lot of that pressure in our society today anyway to work longer hours and be more productive. And this is just another agent in that trend, I think, that's important to look at.
We've talked about why some people feel that they benefit from taking these neuro-enhancing drugs. But mm-hmm. from the research you've done, do they have like an equal benefit for everyone, or only certain people more likely to feel a benefit from drugs like mm-hmm. this?
Individually, I think some people probably, you know, get some placebo effect if they believe in this strongly. Also, in the research that's been done, and there is some data on these drugs in healthy, you know, non-mentally impaired people, where people are given a dose of, say, Provigil, and then asked to perform certain kinds of laboratory tasks that test focus and memory. And in general, they do show an improvement, not across the board, but they show an improvement for most tasks in the studies that have been done. However, they seem to show, interestingly, that they help people more who are kind of in the middle range of intellectual ability than people who are at the higher range, which is kind of surprising, I think. It seems like you might expect it to make smart people smarter. And I think what it seems to suggest is maybe there's kind of a ceiling. If you do quite well at a given memory test, say, already, there's only so much room for improvement. And that may have some real-world applications, too, that these drugs may help people go from kind of the mid-range or high mid-range a little higher in their capacity to do various kinds of jobs and not really help people at the highest end.
Now, you've talked about some of the drugs that are being used as neuroenhancers to increase mm-hmm. focus and productivity. And there's another class of drugs that are being used or look like they might be on the verge of being used this way. And these are drugs that were originally created for things like Alzheimer's disease, for memory mm-hmm. impairment. Can you talk about those drugs?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting about this is this kind of neuropharmaceutical area is really booming because we have an aging population and people who are working longer or want to be able to work longer. And we also have, obviously, you know, the Alzheimer's problem and the memory impairments that come with that. So there are a number of drugs in development that work on various receptors in the brain, many of them with the aim of treating Alzheimer's patients, some with the aim of treating other kinds of cognitive impairments that are associated with mental illnesses like schizophrenia. That's the purpose of these drugs. You know, some of them eventually may also trickle down into the kind of uses I'm talking about here, where people are getting a hold of them one way or another and taking them to give themselves a cognitive boost when they don't have a recognized impairment or diagnosis. And some of them, eventually the uses may be expanded for them too, and what we consider to be unacceptable cognitive decline may also change. You know, the kind of memory loss that a lot of people accept, mild memory loss that a lot of people accept with middle age now, people may no longer feel is acceptable and may be willing to take a drug that helps with that in the future. So I think that may be a direction we're moving in.
One person who you quote in your article who supports the use of these neuroenhancers says, why would you want an upward limit on the intellectual capabilities of a human being? And, you know, that's a pretty convincing way of putting it. On the other hand, one of the things I worry about is that if there's this cosmetic neurology that starts happening, it risks creating a new normal in the way that cosmetic surgery creates a new normal. Suddenly, like, there's so many people who never have wrinkles, so it's no longer normal to have wrinkles as you get older. It's normal to be wrinkle-free in a lot of circles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you don't do that, you're the one who looks abnormal.
Right. I think that the argument you cite by the person who says, why would you want an upper limit on, you know, intellectual capabilities, is something to keep in mind. And I think you're hearing it, including from scientists and neurologists who work in this area. And, you know, their argument is, well, this even has some trickle-down benefits for society. If people who are very smart and are working on cures for diseases and so on, if they are, you know, smarter and more productive, then that will benefit all of us. The British Medical Association came out with a report where, among other arguments, they made that argument. They said, you know, generally making people smarter is considered a good thing. So what, you know, why would we not want that? There's also, I guess, the social inequality argument, which is that this is the kind of thing, like so many benefits that accrue to people at the upper ends of the economic ladder, you know, that this is the kind of people who will get access to these drugs, who will have the savvy to go to a doctor and describe the kind of symptoms that would get them a prescription, who will know about them, whose parents will know about them, are also the kind of people who already, you know, are getting extra help in the form of SAT tutoring or whatever it is, and who already are going to the best schools or whose parents can afford to send them to the best schools, so that it would, you know, there's an argument that it could compound social inequalities that we are already at least somewhat concerned about.
One study that you cite in your New Yorker article says that it's predominantly white males going to Northeast colleges who are members of fraternities who use these neuroenhancing drugs. What's the interpretation of that?
Well, the authors of the study are fairly careful not to extrapolate too much from it, but I think it's an interesting suggestive finding. You know, you can imagine that college campuses that are more competitive and have, you know, higher standards to get in and where people feel a fair amount of academic pressure to keep up, you know, would be more likely to be laboratories of this kind of experimentation. I mean, on this point, I'm just guessing, but fraternities, I would imagine, would be places where people could trade them amongst themselves with greater ease. One of the things that was interesting to me is trying to look a little bit at how people get these drugs on campus. And There are these websites called BoardEt, where students who are in their libraries at their various institutions and ostensibly studying are sort of sending notes to one another on this computer board. And a lot of them, I mean, it's quite common to find on there queries about buying or selling or trading Adderall and Ritalin. And some of the universities where I looked at these sites were some of the leading Ivy League institutions. And so I think that that academic pressure and academic competitiveness is one of the forces contributing to the use of these drugs.
Margaret Talbot, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Margaret Talbot is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her article, Brain Gain, The Underground World of Neuroenhancing Drugs, is published in the current edition. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Should we be concerned that scientists are finding six-legged frogs and male fish with ovaries in the Potomac River in Chesapeake Bay? Journalist Hedrick Smith thinks so. He says the mutations affecting aquatic life in those waters may be connected to chemicals seeping into rivers and lakes around the country that are the sources of much of our drinking water. And these chemicals poisoning our water aren't just coming from industrial plants. They're coming from agriculture, suburban development, and from our cars and chemicals in the products we use every day, like cleansers and toothpaste. Hedrick Smith is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who is senior producer and correspondent for Poisoned Waters, a Frontline documentary which premieres tomorrow night on public television. In 18 months of research, Smith says he's found the nation's water resources face threats which are very different from those which prompted the passage of the Clean Water Act, but no less troubling. Hedrick Smith spoke to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Hedrick Smith, welcome back to Fresh Air. This story begins in Chesapeake Bay. Describe this body of water and its ecological significance for us.
Well, I will, Dave, but just let me say for a moment that I've had a house on the Chesapeake Bay for 30 years. I'm a sailor, I'm a crabber, I'm not a very good fisherman, I'm a swimmer, I'm a hiker. I love the bay. I love the water. So this is an environmental story, but it's also a story of some personal significance to me, reported here and on Puget Sound. Both bodies of water are bodies I know personally. And I think part of that is what's important about these bodies of water. They are great areas of recreation and of importance to the people of many regions, Chesapeake Bay serving six states. These great coastal estuaries like the Chesapeake Bay are marvelous environmental laboratories because their environment is so rich with marine life, with all kinds of topography, and scientists love to study them. And we've been studying it for a long time, being close to the nation's capital. It was one of the areas which the Environmental Protection Agency under Bill Ruckelshaus, who served both President Nixon and President Reagan, singled out for particular attention, trying to gather the six states together to set goals and dramatically reduce the pollution that was so palpable in people's faces back in the 1970s, so bad that if you put your hand in the water in some places, it'd come out with green algae on it. This Chesapeake Bay became one of the places that was afflicted, but also one of the places where the government focused its efforts. And so taking a look at the Chesapeake Bay today is a way of taking the thermometer and applying it to America's waterways generally from coast to coast.
How do we know the bay is in trouble today?
Well, there are any number of indicators. One of them is that today the oysters are down to 2%. The crabs are about 50% of what they were just 25 years ago. You have dead zones that now occupy about 40% of the main stem of the Chesapeake Bay in the heat of summertime, and dead zones are places like the face of the moon, although they're underwater. They're so barren that absolutely nothing can live in them. They kill fish, crabs, wildlife. There are no grasses down there in which all the marine life needs to grow. And that's all been caused by human pollution, by runoff with phosphorus and nitrogen in it that creates algae that when it dies sinks to the bottom and sucks all the oxygen out of the water. And even fish and all these other wildlife creatures, aquatic creatures, need oxygen the same way people do.
Now, as you described a moment ago, in the 1970s, there was national outrage at this extremely visible kind of water pollution, the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland catching fire and Lake Erie appearing, you know, all but dead. And that, of course, prompted Congress to act and enact the Clean Water Act. How is the water pollution that the nation confronted then different from the kinds of threats to places like the Chesapeake Bay and other water, bodies of water today?
Well, in the old days, pollution came basically from large installations. Industry or wastewater treatment plants came out of a pipe. It was known as point source pollution. You could see right where it came from. The modern pollution is much more dispersed. It's much more spread out, whether it's agricultural pollution because of animal manure or fertilizers used on farms or these industrial scale chicken and hog and cattle growing operations, which basically aren't regulated by the Clean Water Act, or it's the stormwater runoff from our roads and our developments and our suburbs, which have all kinds of chemicals in them that come from all kinds of products in our lives. So it's a very different kind. The new pollution is a very different kind of pollution and much harder to get a handle on than the old pollution in the old industrial days.
Right. It's a very different regulatory challenge when you have a pipe to an industrial polluter. Let's talk about agricultural pollution as a piece of this. Now, there have been stories about dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico from all of the agricultural runoff that goes down the Mississippi River. In Chesapeake Bay, which, as you say, is a sort of a good laboratory for examining these issues, you've got the issue of industrial-scale chicken farming in the Delmarva Peninsula, which is Delaware and Maryland and Virginia. How is chicken farming different there now than it used to be, and what's its ecological impact?
Well, essentially, it's done what almost everything else has done in the American economy. It's grown to scale. It's mass production now. It used to be family farms, and family farms used to mean people who raised hundreds, maybe a few thousand chickens. Now there are a couple of million chickens raised on a family farm, but it's now an industry. You fly over it, and it's six or seven sheds, each with 40 or 50,000 chickens in them at any one time, and the growing season has been shortened. And the result is you have this enormous concentration of chicken manure. You've got concentrated growing of chicken, which is efficient, and you've got concentrated growing of manure, which is very troublesome. Just one figure that will capture it. There were 570 million chickens grown on the eastern shore of the Delmarva Peninsula last year, and they produced 1.5 billion pounds of chicken manure. And that's more manure than the human manure from the cities of New York, Washington, San Francisco, and Atlanta all put together. And the human manure gets processed by wastewater treatment plants. The chicken manure doesn't. So a lot of it, when it rains, it's out on the fields. It's just left in piles. Rain hits, washes the manure into the waterways, and you've got E. coli and bacteria, but you've also got phosphorus and nitrogen, which create the algae that creates the dead zone. So there's a direct connection between the dying of the bay and this large unregulated animal manure problem.
And, of course, there's a connection to our lifestyles. We love getting, you know, low-priced food and inexpensive chickens. And there are big companies that process them, Tyson and Perdue. They don't own the chicken farms, right? They buy the chickens from the chicken farmers. Who is responsible what's the relationship? Who's
well,
responsible
actually, it's
for taking
very,
care
it's
of the
very
waste?
Interesting. Chicken growing in America has now become kind of tenant farming. It's a modern tenant farming on a very large scale. It used to be that the chicken growers, the farmers, owned the chickens, and then they sold them after they grew them to the processors. They're called the integrators, the Purdue's, the Tyson's. Actually, now what's going on is that the chicken integrators own everything. They own little baby chicks, which they deliver to the chicken growers and then pick them up 7 or 8 weeks later as grown chickens. They provide the feed. They provide all the medicine to the biology to take care of the chickens. They regularly supervise the chicken growers. They go by there every week or so, make sure the temperature inside the chickens' houses is right. I mean, it's really run as though this were a Japanese keiretsu. There's the big company at the top, and these are the little guys at the bottom, and they salute and follow the orders of the people at the top. But the amazing thing is the big chicken integrators own everything except the manure, or if chickens die while the farmers are growing them, baby chicks, they don't own the dead chickens. In other words, they own all the good stuff, and they don't own any of the bad stuff.
And when you say chicken integrators, you mean these big companies like Tyson and Perdue, right?
That's what I mean. They integrate the whole process. That's why they're called a chicken integrator.
So they don't take responsibility for disposal of the manure, and farmers leave it runs off their farms into streams and into the bay.
Well, the argument was, and there was some logic to it historically, that farmers who raised chickens and also grew corn or soybeans or whatever, they needed the manure from the chickens to fertilize their fields. It was a good deal. And so long as you did this at a fairly small scale, there was a reasonable balance between the amount of manure produced and the amount of manure that was needed. But when you went to industrial scale with multi-billion dollar companies, it went off the charts. There was just way, way, way too much manure for the local farmers to be able to absorb. And maybe there are other places in the country, golf courses, Augusta National, whatever, across the country that need chicken manure, but no farmer can afford to ship it down there. So it gets left right on the Delmarva Peninsula. And farmers often didn't even have sheds to store it in. And so it sat out in the fields. And when the rain came, it just washed the manure down into the waterways. Now there are regulations sort of saying you got to create sheds and put it under sheds, but then there's a question as to whether or not either the federal government or state government has enough inspectors to check on this. I think with the cattle farms in Pennsylvania, there's something like one or two inspectors for 14 counties. They don't get around to see very much whether or not the manure is properly cared for.
Now, just to be clear, there are technological solutions to this if regulators will adopt them?
Well, there are a variety of solutions to this. I mean, one thing is Purdue has pioneered making pellets, taking the manure, taking it to a processing plant, squeezing all the water out of it, drying it, and then making it granular, and then somehow finding ways to ship it. I mentioned a few moments ago golf courses across the country. There are golf courses and other places around the country that do need manure. If it can be packaged, fertilizer, they need it, they'll take it. But that's only about 10% of the excess manure. Another thing to do is to ship it to other areas by truck. There are some people who think that there may be technology which will be able to convert manure into energy, that you can eventually make power plants out of it. Now, how you're going to do that without polluting the air and turning around and then have it pollute the water again and stink up the whole place is not yet clear. The technological answers haven't come through. But there are people who are talking about that as one of the ultimate solutions. But we're quite a ways away from that.
I wanted to talk about some of the new chemicals that are appearing in waterways. And this is dramatically illustrated in the documentary by some of the aquatic life in the Potomac River. What are you seeing with some of these animals?
Well, part of what happened was some years ago, the people in charge of the Fish and Game Commissions in Virginia and West Virginia began noticing unusual fish kills in the upper Potomac, the Shenandoah River, and they couldn't explain them. There'd be hundreds of fish found floating belly up. And so they called in the U.S. Geological Survey and some other scientists to try to figure out what was going on. And they began to find not only fish kills, but they began to find abnormalities in the fish. One problem called intersex, which is female eggs in the male gonads of smallmouth bass. That's a very alarming thing. I mean, elsewhere in the country, they found alligators with small penises. They found frogs with six legs. They found mutations that are, when you stop to think about them, are really horrible. If they happen to human beings, people would be up in arms. And these are warnings, the scientists now believe, about what's in these waters.
So what do they think might be causing this?
Well, these are apparently chemicals that are in many, many modern products of our modern lifestyle. I mean, we're talking about chemicals, believe it or not, in our toothpaste, in our deodorants, in our skin creams, in our shampoos, in our household cleaning items, in the pesticides and herbicides that we put on our lawns to make them pretty and green. In many of the things that come off our cars, we're not aware of it, but as we drive down the road, our cars drop oil and grease, hydrocarbons, but they also drop bits of metal and heavy metals, chromium, aluminum, mercury, lots of other heavy metals, including copper, which is pervasive, are bad for nature, and scientists have begun to trace them back as sources of either killing, maiming, or distorting the growth of various different fish and creatures. And now scientists are starting to say, there's growing evidence that they pose a health threat to human beings in very, very serious areas like cancer, like reproductive skills. I mean, the lower sperm count among men And then distortions in infant children when they're born and their urinary tracts and so forth. So it's a really disturbing trend, and science hasn't gotten to the bottom of it, and the EPA has not yet figured out how to regulate it.
And just to be clear, we're not talking about chemicals which are a byproduct of an industrial process and piped into a body of water. We're talking about stuff that is in stormwater runoff, byproducts of the chemicals that we use in our lives.
Yeah, this is a radically different kind of pollution than the pollution we started out worrying about back in the 1970s, that old industrial pollution. This is pervasive. These are products that are throughout our economy. You walk down the aisles of a grocery store and you're looking at a lot of these products every day. These are products that are now built into our modern lifestyles. As a matter of fact, it's very interesting. Just the other day, the EPA announced for the first time, and this is a big change over the last decade or so, they announced that they were going to ask a number of companies to check into the certain chemicals, 65 specific chemicals, in these kinds of products. And some of the companies have begun to disclose some of these chemicals, and some states, Washington State, for example, has regulated PBDEs, which are flame retardants that are in children's pajamas, that are in computers, that are in couches, that are in rugs. These things, we don't even think about them. We don't see them. In fact, that's a telltale sign of modern pollution. It is largely invisible. It's not like the old pollution, which was visible and palpable. This stuff you can't see. You don't realize it's there. And I think that's one reason why the public isn't as concerned about how our environment is and how our waterways are, the same way it was back in the 70s.
Right. Now, I live in Philadelphia. My drinking water gets drawn from the Schuylkill and Delaware rivers, and people all over the country get water from nearby bodies of water. And unlike decades ago, it's now treated. There are standards and there are treatment plants. To what extent are levels of these new chemicals measured in our drinking water or treated in the plants?
Well, the first thing you need to know is that the water that gets into whatever drinking water system you're using comes from upriver. And upriver, there are cities and communities as well as farming areas and so forth that have used the water before. So almost everybody's using somebody else's wastewater that has been treated. So how well it's treated upstream is very important. But when you get to these new chemicals, they've come into being since standards were set. And what we were told by scientists and by the U.S. Geological Survey is that there are no standards set. And frankly, only very recently, only in the last 2 or 3 years, have scientists developed the methods to detect these chemicals at the very small levels at which they exist. But these chemicals are very harmful to nature and potentially very harmful to humans at extremely low levels. So, number one, there are no safety standards. And number two, there aren't the filters. The old filters won't catch them. We had one example here in the Washington Aqueduct, which takes the drinking water for the nation's capital from the Potomac River. The U.S. Geological Survey did some testing on that water body. They had a watch list of 300 chemicals. They found 85 of them in the water going into the intakes for the Washington drinking water system. And 2/3 of those made it through the filters into the tap water, into the drinking water of the people of Washington, D.C. So the answer is the old standards and the old filters are not catching these new chemical dangers.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Hedrick Smith. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's also senior producer and correspondent of the new upcoming Frontline program, Poisoned Waters. You talk in the documentary about the threat that unregulated development poses to the nation's bodies of water. Happens all over the country. One of the most extreme cases is Tysons Corner, Virginia. What makes it unique?
Yeah, Tysons is a fascinating story. It's a story that sort of epitomizes America's romance with the car and the fantastic explosion and sprawl of edge cities, of suburbs that become almost bigger than cities themselves. Tysons Corner 50 years ago was a crossroads, literally a corner, in the midst of huge dairy farms, open farms, about halfway between the National Airport and where is now Dulles, or halfway between the Pentagon and what is now Dulles Airport. It is today an edge city where 120,000 people work every day. larger than downtown Boston or downtown Phoenix or downtown Atlanta with a bigger workforce. It is absolutely choked with traffic. It has something like 47 million square feet of office space and 40 million square feet of parking lots. Parking lots are devastating for the environment because they gather all kinds of dirt and all kinds of chemicals, and particularly I mentioned before the chemicals that come off cars, oil, grease, hydrocarbons, metals, all kinds of industrial stuff that gets dumped and things that people throw away and so forth. And when it rains, it's just a sea. It's just sheets of water sliding down into the nearby creeks into the Potomac River and into Chesapeake Bay. So from this environmental standpoint, it's murder. And now, even for the people who are the business leaders of Tyson's Corner, it is choking on its own success. They're dying from cars, and they're trying to figure out some way to get out of it. And what's interesting is some of the thinking is sort of changing at Tyson's Corner about what's the right way to go. Growth is coming, but how do we handle it?
And one of the issues at Tyson's is that it really wasn't. It was planned as a destination for work. It's an office area, not a residential community, right?
Yeah, that's one of the problems. I mean, cities grow up and you have a mix of commerce and residence and industry. And Tyson's Corner was both one of the country's biggest shopping malls. I think it's fifth or sixth largest shopping mall. And it's a huge office center with lots of the Beltway bandits who are contractors of the Pentagon, National Security Agency, CIA, whatever, all kinds of people work there. And they all travel there by car. And only about 5 or 8% of them live there. Everybody commutes. So it's just an unbelievable continuous traffic jam almost around the clock.
Now, you point out that there's an alternative development model nearby in Arlington. Describe that.
Well, what's interesting is Arlington didn't have quite the same set of choices, but it basically decided to build its development around the metro system, which is Washington's subway system, and sometimes in the Virginia suburbs it's on the surface. But metro connects suburbs in Maryland and Virginia with downtown Washington, D.C. and the whole District of Columbia. And they have a corridor in which they did development which had about 5 or 6 metro stops in Arlington, which is just across the Potomac River from D.C., and around that area, over the last 25 or 30 years, population has doubled or tripled, the job numbers have doubled or tripled, and the number of cars has stayed roughly the same, so that you have not increased the congestion. They've been very careful with the development of the way they handle stormwater runoff, with the way they process the water, the way they channel the water. And the result is that Arlington has had enormous growth, enormous economic prosperity, without any of the environmental or even traffic headaches that the county next door, where Tyson's Corner exists, has had. So people are sort of comparing these two development models. Arlington is called smart growth. It's growing up, not growing out. They built new apartment and office buildings on top of old used car lots and old parking lots. So the amount of impervious surfaces, paved surfaces, asphalt, concrete, has not increased. So that the water is still hitting the same area. And actually, there are more green spaces in the county than there were before. Not a lot, but a little bit. And the green spaces in the counties further out, further away from the city, have not been eaten up by suburban sprawl, in part thanks to the concentrated development in Arlington.
You know, one of the interesting things about the ecological impacts of this kind of development, the kind of development which paves over huge areas and creates harmful stormwater runoff, is that it's different from the kind of pollution that we're accustomed to thinking of being the subject of federal regulation. The truth is that development is largely a matter of local officials, city officials, county zoning boards. So to deal with this, what do you need? Citizen activists who demand a different approach?
Well, I have to say, Dave, one of the things that really interested me in doing this documentary was to discover, first of all, I was shocked by how bad the problem is and how long we put it on the back burner. And you can do that for a while, but after 25 years of deregulation, it's being on the back burner. We need to do something. But the other thing that struck me was that when communities get involved and there is grassroots civic action, they can have a real impact. I mean, the decision to go to Smart Growth in Arlington County was a decision made by the Arlington County Council. It wasn't dictated by the federal government. It wasn't dictated even by the state government of Virginia. And there was a lot of interchange between the county government and all kinds of communities in Arlington. So it was a very grassroots democratic process. And in two counties over, in Loudoun County, they have in recent years had a horrendous battle between people who are trying to preserve the county as having a lot of green space but still being handy to the metropolitan area against developers who are for pell-mell development, and they want to go the way of Tyson's Corner with intense sprawl and bringing in all this traffic and building many more highways. And the local activists, led by a group called the Piedmont Environmental Council, really energized all kinds of local activists to oppose this pell-mell growth, to try to keep growth channel into certain areas. And the argument really wasn't, interestingly enough, about the environment. Chris Miller, the head of the Piedmont Environmental Council, says you've got to retail environmental politics. You've got to make it relevant to people about what's going on in their backyard. And that's traffic congestion. That's rising tax rates, paying the cost that the developers need for the infrastructure that makes it profitable for them to move in, and building many more new schools and having your kids jump from one school to another. These are enormous headaches for the people in Loudoun County. So they effectively fought off uncontrolled development. They didn't say they were for no growth, but they tried to channel the growth into certain areas and to manage it. And in both communities, Arlington County and in Loudoun County, I mean, it does show that if you get involved, you can have an impact.
Well, we're out of time. Hedrick Smith, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Hedrick Smith spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Smith is the senior producer and correspondent for tomorrow night's PBS Frontline documentary, Poisoned Waters. Dave Davies is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.